Welcome to Layer Zero. Layer Zero is a podcast focusing on the people that make up the Ethereum community. Crypto is built by code, but it's composed by people, and each individual member of the crypto community has their own story to tell. Cypherpunks understood that the code they write impacts the people that use it, and Layer Zero focuses on the people behind the code because Ethereum is people all the way down, and it always has been. Today on Layer Zero, we're talking with Cami Russo, the chief S of The Defiant. And Cami, I think, has one of the most interesting stories and interesting backgrounds that I've heard so far. She has a very just logical process, and we talked about this, a logical process of like who she is definitely an A plus B equals C conclusion out of her parents and her family. She's got that entrepreneurial spirit. She's got a drive to create. She's got an intrinsic interest in journalism. And it kind of has like logically concluded with where she is at now, which is at The Defiant. But we start at the very beginning. We start at her time as a child in Chile, when she moved again as a young kid to Miami, then back to Chile for a degree in journalism, and then moving into her time at Bloomberg. And it was overall just a fascinating story. And I'm having a ton of fun doing these Layer Zeros because I just get to sit back for an hour and a half and hear story time from each of these individual guests. And I think Cami's story has been one of my favorites so far. We definitely tap on the differences at the very end between Bankless and The Defiant. So that was a fun little thing to hear. And we also talk about, I share my perception as to how Cami's book that she wrote changed the course of Ethereum for the much, much better. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Cami Russo, one of the best leaders in this space. But first, before we get there, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible.
Matcha, everyone's favorite DEX aggregator, has just launched an open beta for gasless trading. So if you're trading more than $5,000 in common ETH and wrapped Bitcoin pairs, then your gas fees on Matcha are free. And that's why you should be using Matcha. Matcha routes your orders across all the various DeFi exchanges on Ethereum, Polygon, Binance Smart Chain, and gives you the best possible price without any trading fees or unnecessary slippage. Matcha has smart order routing that splits your orders across multiple liquidity sources if Matcha sees that it gets you better pricing. Trading on Matcha is super easy because it pools the liquidity for me into a single and easy to use platform, and has even saved me multiple times from accidentally picking the wrong decks to trade on and getting a bad price. Matcha also allows you to make limit orders on chain so you can set and forget your DeFi trades, and they will go through automatically while you're away. So when you're making a trade, head over to matcha.xyz/bankless, connect your wallet, and start getting some of the best prices and most liquidity when you trade your crypto assets. Alchemix is one of the coolest new DeFi apps on the scene. It introduces self-paying loans, allowing you to spend and save at the same time. Deposit the DAI stablecoin into the Alchemix vault in order to get an advance on the interest it generates. Borrow up to 50% of the total amount of your deposited DAI in the form of AL-USD stablecoin. Here's the craziest part. The loan pays itself back and you cannot be liquidated. Unlock your assets potential in the ultimate DeFi savings account. And brand new to Alchemix is the ETH vault, where you can deposit ETH into the application, borrow AL-ETH against your deposits, while having your advance gradually paid back over time. V2 is rapidly approaching, which will allow for even more collateral types, plus a variety of yield strategies to choose from. Harness the power of Alchemix at alchemix.fi. That's alchemix.fi. Follow Alchemix on Twitter at alchemixfi and join the Discord to keep up to date with Alchemix V2 and to get involved in governance.
Hey, Cami, how's it going?
Hi, David. All good.
So we were just talking before we hit record as two people who both have their own YouTubes and then also consume other people's YouTubes. I had to ask you the questions like, wait, have we talked before or have we not talked before? Like, it's actually kind of hard after like 2 years of making and also consuming content to remember if we've actually been into the same Zoom. But we've decided that, no, this is actually the first time.
Yeah, and it's so great to finally do it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, absolutely. So congratulations with everything you've built at The Defiant. And I definitely want to hear about that story, but I think I want to get there in the second half. And so the first half, I want to hear just a little bit more about your background and what about your younger years caused you to become the person that you are today. So let's go all the way back. Cami, where were you raised?
I was raised in Santiago, Chile, South America. Yeah.
Where in Chile?
Santiago, the
Oh,
capital.
right. Okay, and that's like right in the middle, right?
Yeah, it's right in the center of Chile, in the middle of the mountains. So yeah, it's a nice city. One of it used to be one of the most stable and, like, I don't know, like one of the few places that just, like, worked in South America. So it's funny, like, growing up, I didn't have a lot of the issues that a lot of other people in South America had to deal with. Like, didn't hear about inflation or, like, currency controls or, like, scarcity of goods or anything like that. Chile is, like, actually really close, or has been historically very close to the US. So it has, like, a bunch of, trade deals everywhere, and it's, like, pretty open. Like, that's, I grew up in this, like, bubble within South America, where everything was fine, everything worked. Like, you didn't have that, like, crazy instability. But then later on, I moved to Argentina, and that's where I got a taste of all that craziness. So it's a
Right, the Argentinian story is the story that you hear a lot of, right? Mariano Conti tells this story a lot. Patricio tells a story a lot of exactly what you just described, right? And that's kind of been the kind of like crypto rallying cries, like, oh, look at the capital controls and the inflation going on in Argentina. It's interesting that like literally right next door is a country that didn't have that history. Well, how would you describe the Chilean economy growing up? Like, was there like for what I'm familiar with Argentina, it's very big in like, beef and agriculture and also tech. What were you surrounded by growing up in Chile?
Well, and before I go into that, that dichotomy is so interesting, because actually, when my parents were growing up in Chile, it was the other way around, and even more so, like, my grandparents. Argentina was, like, the big, like, stable, or not stable, but just, like, growing economic force in kind of the southern cone of South America. And Chile was just, like, this really, like, poor, like, struggling country. And then the roles, like, really, really kind of, like, two generations. So it's like, it's really interesting to see that, how that happened. And it's all because of just, like, very populist policies implemented in Argentina, while there were more, like, free market policies implemented in Chile. But yeah, like, the Chile's main export is copper, so very much commodity led economy. But my parents were both pretty entrepreneurial, and my whole family is. So
So that's where you get it from.
yep. I have a really great example set with my family. So yeah, my dad is an engineer. My mom studied art advertising, but never really. She was like, she started a toy importer in Chile. So, like, when she had me, she was looking for just educational toys for kids, and she couldn't find, like, any quality toys that didn't have, like, harmful, like, materials and stuff like that. And so she started importing Fisher-Price toys into Chile, and was, like, one of the first, or, like, the first person to do that. So she and my dad set up a toy store, which was very convenient for me growing up.
Wow, the kid with the parents that have a toy store, you must have been a hit.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. So in growing up, were you exposed to any like things that you have been able to like repurpose now? Like when did you get like your access to your first computer? When did like what was did you ever have like an entrepreneurial experience or anything with computer science? Like anything that is like now related to crypto? What was like the earliest part of your childhood or growing up phase where you actually was like, oh yeah, so I was doing this as a kid and now I do this as an adult?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, like, just like a computer access, I think, is pretty similar to what any, like, kid in the US had. Like, I don't know, like, I had my computer room growing up, like, had just, like, got like a Facebook account very early on, and remember like transitioning from floppy disks to like CDs and like all that. Like, yeah, you can. I'm dating myself for sure. I'm an older millennial here. So all of that, I don't think is like too different. I think maybe like some of the influences, like I said, it's just like all of my family is somewhat entrepreneurial. My younger brother, he's 3 years younger than me. He never had an actual job. Like, unlike me, who like I went in a more traditional direction, going into Bloomberg after studying journalism in university. And it took me like, you know, almost over 10 years to actually start, like quit and start my own company. My brother never had like a full-time job. Like, he's always been a full-time entrepreneur. He started this kind of like Yelp, like early version of Yelp in Chile for restaurants in Santiago. Then he had this like Instagram for pets called Kloof. And he was actually part of TechStars, which is like a big incubator. And he lived in New York before I did for TechStars. And now he has a liquor company called Candela. And he got the idea of the liquor company in a trip to the Dominican Republic. And I was there when he got the idea. Like, we went up to the bar in the resort. And we were like, okay, give us like the what you drink, like we don't right. like piña coladas and stuff. And so he made us try Mama Juana, which was like, it's like the local rum, like a spiced rum that they drink in the Dominican Republic. And we loved it. And so my brother was like, I can't believe like they don't sell this outside of the DR. And so that's, you know, what he does now. Like, he's now based in Miami and has his own kind of liquor company. So I have like that example, my parents' example. And so I always thought it was like feasible to quit everything and start your own thing. Like, if that was like actually like a career path that didn't seem so outlandish to me growing up, because I had like all these different examples of people who did it. And then from like the journalism side, I've always loved writing. So I moved to Miami for a brief period when I was growing up. I lived there for 3 years, and I was 9 years old. And when I moved, my grandmother gave me a journal, and she's like, "You're gonna want to write everything down." And I think that's kind of what started it, because I got to Miami and was like, you know, dealing with all these different experiences and emotions, and like missing home, but also learning so much and having a good time and like all this stuff. And so I started just like writing everything down on this journal. And from then on, like I always kept journals, and it just like, I don't know, I think it made me like writing ever since. So, and then my mom was editor-in-chief for Condé Nast, for a bunch of like Spanish versions of like big magazines like Glamour, Vogue, Discover, like a lot of Condé Nast magazines she helped run. So like I just grew up in like the editorial and publishing world. Like I loved going with my mom over the weekend to the office, like making sure that everything was closed. Like I saw just like the printouts of like magazine covers, and I just loved that whole world. So that kind of writing plus that experience really just made me want to be a journalist. And yeah, here I am.
That's such an easy story to have, like, all right, like A plus B equals C, right? So like, you know, Cammy, daughter of a very entrepreneurial family, entrepreneurial brother, grandma gives you a journal, come to America, which is like a very transitional moment. Like, you go moving from A to B anywhere, and then you are given a journal to help, you know, deal with the emotions of, you know, a change. And then all of a sudden we have Cammy, the entrepreneurial journalist writer operating the Defiance. It's such a very logical conclusion,
right?
of like the rest of your family. Yeah.
There's a quote, and actually my brother said it at my wedding. And it always sticks with me. It's like, it's always easy to connect the dots looking backwards. Mm. So now it makes sense, right? But you know, at the time I had no idea I would end up living in New York, running my own media company. You know, it's like I never imagined that when I went into journalism in the first place.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Where did you go for journalism? What university?
University in Chile, Universidad Católica, mm-hmm. like one of the good ones in Chile. Then I worked at a newspaper there, El Mercurio. It's like one of the bigger or the biggest newspaper in Chile. And so I was like working in El Mercurio, and I had this woman next to me who, she's amazing, I love her. But you know, she had been there, I think, like at that same desk for 30 years. And so, because it's like you get to El Mercurio and you don't move. It's like it's an institution in Chile, like everyone reads it. So I was like, okay, I'm already here, like I don't want to be here in like the next 30 years. Like what should I do next? And you know, having the experience of having lived in the US when I was growing up, again, like it felt like, okay, like maybe I should look beyond Chile and see what's out there. And so I applied to different journalism schools here, with always like the goal of getting a big, like a job at a big US media company. That was like my end goal. And so to do that, I realized that I needed a degree from a US school, because nobody would look at my degree from Universidad Católica and be like, sure, yeah, come join the New York Times. so yeah, I applied to different schools and got into Northwestern. And from there, I got into Bloomberg, into like the Bloomberg internship.
So throughout that process, when you were writing either at your job or practicing for your job, what was the subject matter that you were focused on? Because we're not at the crypto part of this story, right? Like we're still mm-hmm. pre-crypto. So like what captured your attention while you were a writer?
I think, let's see. Well, in El Mercurio, I was in the international news section. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's something I enjoyed. It's funny, like, before getting to Northwestern on Bloomberg, I never really looked at financial markets or anything close to crypto. I got into journalism. I like writing, and it's like I like the more, I don't know, like I never saw myself as a like numbers person. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I gravitated more towards like politics, you know, stories. It's funny, in El Mercurio, they initially wanted me to do like the social pages. And so they called me up and they were like, okay, yeah, you're in, your first job is going to be in the social pages. And that's been like, you know, like following like local celebrities around. And I turned it down. I was like, no, I didn't get into journalism to do this. And they're like, what, you're turning down a job at El Mercurio? I'm like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. And then they came back and were like, fine, you can cover international politics. That was a big improvement. So yeah, that's kind of what I did. Mm-hmm. And then in Northwestern, I had to choose between different kind of topics for the reporting class. And there was like politics, business, like environment and art or something. And I thought, you know, like, I'm paying a bunch of money to be here. Like, I took a loan to go to Northwestern. So it was like, this better pay off or else, you know. Right. And so I thought, you know, I need to make this worthwhile and learn something I don't actually know. So I thought, like, going into, like, the business reporting class would be the most useful, because I had no idea about anything about business. And I discovered that I actually really like reporting, you know, writing about money, like reporting about, like, you know, markets. Because to me, it was nice to find a more objective way of telling stories, right? Like in politics, it's like always one side versus the other, and he said, she said, and you don't have like a fact that you can present and be like, this is what's happening. And it's pretty kind of hard to dispute. And with like markets and business stories, you know, there's like different ways to interpret numbers, but in the end, a stock is going up and it's going up and it's going down and it's going down. And if like countries' bond yields actually are like, it are a really good way of representing how thousands of people think about one country, you know? So I just thought that was really interesting and just like a very like truthful way of seeing the world and presenting the world. So I was really excited by this discovery and I just, yeah, I decided to just like focus on that, on like business and market reporting. And then we had this like field trip to the Bloomberg office in Chicago because Northwestern is in Chicago. And I was like blown away by the power of the Bloomberg terminal. Like there's this like black box that just like gets you all the data you could possibly want. And it's just like connected to all the like decision makers of the world, and all of these, you know, big brains are consuming your news and your stories. And I'm like, okay, this is where I want to be. So that led me to apply to the internship there.
So is all of your like your understanding of like money, business, economics done like on the, is like on the job training? Like you had to do, like you still never took a class. So you only ever learned about this just by teaching yourself.
Yeah, it was crazy. Right. Like I had this like business journalism class from Northwestern, which I mean, they did like teach the basics of like economics, but that was pretty much it. Like that was my background going into Bloomberg. And yeah, you learn everything on the job, and you have, you know, this amazing tool that the like professional like fund managers and like central bank economists all over the world use, but and you're just like starting out as, you know, the first job as a journalist, and you have the same tool. It's like it like really forces you to understand things like, oh, like what is a bond yield and writing about all that stuff. Yeah, it's like I learned really quickly that I just had to lose the fear of asking dumb questions, because, you know, it's like I had to get a story out at the end of the day, and I had to at least like I had to understand it obviously to write it. So I would like get on the phone and just like ask like everything, like explain what a stock is, you know. And like literally it was like, because like I started like calling sources, and then they would and reporters, like more senior reporters, would help me out and just like write out questions that they needed for their stories. And then I remember like having these conversations where I would just like go down the list of questions, and I had no idea what the person was answering, like what the answer was. So I could like couldn't do any follow up, couldn't like follow the conversation. So then I just like started like asking my own questions and was like, okay, but what do you mean by that? Yeah. And that's really how I learned everything I know about finance and markets. 8 years at Bloomberg.
When you started asking your own questions, did that, like, was that really just you trying to educate yourself, or was that you learning to be a reporter of your own style? And because for me, sometimes I try and I try and find the question that other people want me to ask, but then there's always like, okay, well, if that's not the question that I truly want to ask, maybe the question that I truly want to ask is also the same question that other people have too.
Yeah, totally.
Can you reflect on that for a moment?
Yeah. And by the way, I think you're an awesome interviewer. Like,
thank you.
Yeah, no, like all these questions, I don't think I've heard them before. So yeah.
Well, that's hopefully why people tune into the Layer Zeros. That's what they're meant for.
No, really great. It was definitely both. Like I was trying to learn and understand what the story was about, so I could write it. But yeah, I was learning to be a journalist as well as learning about finance and markets. So You know, it's like once you get a taste of having a scoop, of like having a really well-read story, of like, I don't know, getting like a really like cool and important source, it's really addictive, you know. So it's like, okay, like you get that taste and you want to do it again. So you try to like get something out of your interviewer that nobody has, and I think, yeah, it's like that dopamine of like the views and like just like uncovering things that haven't been said before. It's kind of what starts to drive you as a journalist.
Yeah, can you go into that a little more? I think I find that extremely fascinating. Like the dopamine hit of like discovering a scoop. Do you have a story where you like got a scoop and what, you're just like furiously typing, trying to get the scoop out the door as fast as possible? You have a story like that?
Yeah. So, okay. The first one that comes to mind in Argentina, there was this period of time where everyone, or it seemed like everyone, was leaving Argentina, just like running out the door, because the president, Cristina Fernandez, had turned like just even more anti like international companies and anti-free market. So like there was like a bunch of stories breaking everywhere about like this fund was leaving or this company was leaving, and there was like a source that I about like a source from a pretty big hedge fund based there, and they were like really big in Argentina. Like they were like big, really big investors in Argentine bonds and stocks. And so I always call this guy. And I remember there was like one week where I called him and he just like wasn't picking up. And then I called again, no answer. Then I called like not his direct phone, but like the like general number. Nobody was picking up. So I was like, I wonder, like, maybe these guys are all like have also left. And so like I remember like going through like different ways to try to confirm. And so I think I asked him directly, but like he didn't say. And then there was like one of the fund and guys was based in London, and I had like chatted with him a couple of times. So I called him up and I was like, hey, so I asked the question in a way that assumed that they had left Argentina. So I was like, hey, so like, when are you like, when's your last day in Argentina? Or I don't remember what I asked, but like, it was like a question like that.
It was like a clever framing. Is that the gist? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Like it assumed, like the question assumed that they had left. So, he answered something like, oh yeah, like we're like tomorrow's our last day or something. Like he answered the question kind of like basically confirming that they were leaving. And so I was like, huh, okay. So I'm just wondering, like, is the reason you're leaving because of Argentina's really, really bad, like unfriendly policies? Oh yeah, totally. Like they suck, whatever. That's not the actual quote, but.
Sure.
And
meaning is there, but quote's not there, but meaning is there. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, oh my God, like I got this scoop, like this big fund is leaving Argentina. Wrote that up, like big headlines, like tons of hits. And then I got like this enraged call from the guy who gave me the quote. And he's like, I thought you were like, I didn't come like, I don't know. He like, and I record everything. And so I had the thing, and he complained to my boss. He's like, I didn't mean for that to be the news and whatever. And like, I called, I asked you, this is what you said. I have the recording. I have the quote. Like, and it was this whole thing. Like my editor had to like look at my notes and my recording, and they were like, nope, Camila's right. Like, is this false? Like, are you not leaving? They were like, well, yeah, actually we are.
He confirms it twice. That's awesome. Okay, so what motivates the scoop? Is it like the thrill? Is it like the possibility of like fame and prowess? Is it just like becoming a better journalist? Like what motivates the scoop?
I don't know. It's a mix of all of that. You know, it's like it's fun. It's fun to uncover stuff. You know, it's like you feel like a detective. And really, like if your job is to just you know, report on what's happening. I mean, what better way to do it if you're reporting something that nobody else has reported? It's right. Like, you know, the ultimate reporting. So yeah, it's fun.
Like finding buried treasure.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Though I'll say, like, scoops aren't really kind of my specialty. Like, I love like getting them, but I think I enjoy even more just like the feature type of story, you know, like having long interviews, going on site to see things and just like be able to like build a narrative around that. And it can still be kind of scoopy, you know, it can be like a story that nobody else has reported. But I like the more like feature kind of analytical, type of story, not just like, oh, like this happened.
Right. The longer forms, the stories, not the breaking news. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think at this point in your, we kind of went on a side quest to talk about scoops, but where we were was you were working at Bloomberg, being a journalist, and had just gotten into markets and business and finance and all that stuff. And I think what comes next is the Ethereum side of things. Is that right?
No, not quite. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so first comes, before Ethereum, actually comes Bitcoin in my timeline. So in Argentina, this was 2013. And I was reporting on like inflation and currency controls and like all the different ways investors had to, you know, protect themselves against it. And, you know, I've told this story before, but it's really like what has shaped my view of the world and why I think crypto is so valuable. And it's my own experience with inflation and currency controls, because I was earning Argentine pesos as a Bloomberg reporter in Argentina. So I really felt, you know, the impact of what inflation can do to your savings. You know, it's like 25% inflation at the time that I was there meant, you know, keeping any pesos in the bank meant losing out on my savings and my money. So like, as soon as I got to Argentina, the first thing I was told was, you need to convert your pesos to dollars. And that's how everyone thinks. Like, everyone thinks in dollars. And if you ask anyone on the street, they'll tell you the exact dollar rate that day. Like, it's just like very kind of ingrained in Argentine culture. And so to have like the president one day announce you can't buy dollars anymore, it was just like a huge shock. Like, how could it be that like the government can one day tell me what I can and can't do with the money that I earn, and that's in like my bank account? So that like really shook me. Like I literally, like after the announcement, I still had some like Argentine pesos in my bank account. And before I had a peso account and a dollar account. And there was just like this very easy way of transferring money from one account to another. And then after the announcement, like I went to my bank and the option just like wasn't there anymore. Like just like wasn't there. So I'm like stuck in pesos for like whatever amount I had.
Got rugged.
Yeah. Rugged by the Argentine government. So then like actually like an Argentine Bloomberg reporter who was based in Spain told me, there's this Bitcoin thing that's really gaining steam in Argentina. Like I have like a bunch of friends talking about it, going to meetups and stuff. So I looked into it and had to convince my editors at Bloomberg that this was actually kind of worth reporting. And that's kind of the first story I wrote about crypto ever in 2013. And then from there, I was just like, really interested. I was like, okay, this is really valuable. It's a currency that's independent, that doesn't have any central banks or, you know, can't be censored and so on. So that was kind of my first look at crypto.
That story that you wrote, in 2013, right after you experienced capital controls. You said you wrote that was the first story that you wrote. Was it a story about people using Bitcoin as a result of the capital controls, or was it more just a story about Bitcoin itself? And the only thing that it was the capital control story that motivated the story. What was the actual story?
Yeah, no, it was a story about, you know, there's all this inflation, there's capital controls, and there's this like growing community in Argentina that is using Bitcoin to protect themselves against inflation. And so the story looked at that, like interviewed a couple of people in Argentina who were like buying Bitcoin, I think, and then just like gave context, oh, like Bitcoin this year surpassed $1,000 for the first time and blah, blah, you know.
So I made the naive mistake of assuming that you started off with Ethereum somehow, because I always thought that like you had gotten into writing for Bloomberg and then learned about this Ethereum thing and then wanted to write about Ethereum. I actually didn't know that you actually had such an early history with Bitcoin all the way back in 2013.
Yeah, but it was like that one story. Mm-hmm. After that, like I just like kept writing market stories about Argentina, and then I moved to Madrid. I was there for 2.5 years, writing about European stocks. Like didn't think about crypto very much at all at the time.
So the Bitcoin brain virus didn't make it into your head?
No, it's just like something like, oh, like this is interesting. Mm-hmm. This is like really cool. But no, it didn't like totally consume me. Like it didn't go down like this like rabbit hole that like dragged me in and like didn't let me out. No, like it was like, okay, this is interesting, this is valuable, I see that crypto is cool. But then I just like kept on with my life. Unfortunately, I didn't even buy Bitcoin at the time. I kept, you know, writing just like regular TradFi market stories. Mm-hmm. And until I moved back to New York with Bloomberg in 2017. And at the time I was with this team called Markets Live, which just blogged about like real-time market moves for the Bloomberg terminal. And it was cool because like we had the flexibility of writing about whatever was interesting in the market. And it was just like quick blog posts, like maybe like two graphs and a chart or something. And so 2017, obviously huge year for crypto. And because I was already like, I knew something about it, I had kind of like kept just like informed about the space. And so I just like kept writing like blog posts for Markets Live. And then my editors were actually interested in me covering crypto for like elsewhere in Bloomberg, because it was just like huge demand and interest right. for crypto that year. Like anything with Bitcoin on the headline would jump to most read on the Bloomberg terminal. And there just like weren't any like dedicated crypto journalists at Bloomberg. And since I had an interest, they were like, can you cover this thing? So I started to have this like second job, which was to cover the crypto market. And that's when I learned about Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And because like a lot of the story that year was ICOs.
Right.
So
right.
I wrote the first like ICO story for Bloomberg and trying to like understand, like it was just like very strange to me. Like all these different coins, like where do they come from? Like, what are they?
And why then does every single one pump?
Right. Everything is green. It was really strange. And then I realized, oh, like all of these coins come from this like mega coin, like Ethereum.
I have never heard Ethereum be called the mega coin yet. Yeah. But that's awesome.
Yeah. Like this is the origin of like all these coins is this thing. So I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. And yeah, that's kind of how I started like really writing about crypto and just like never stopped writing since 2017. And that really just like fascinated me and consumed me. And then end of 2017, I pitched to write a book on Ethereum. And And yeah, like writing for the Infinite Machine, that like really, it was like Ethereum was like all I thought about for like 2 years.
Why did Ethereum consume you in a way that Bitcoin didn't?
You know, like, I think the truth is I just thought the stories behind Ethereum were more interesting, just like the people behind Ethereum. I mean, on one hand, like the story of Bitcoin had pretty much, you know, had been told. And I don't like you didn't find as much activity then, even then, like, of course, like now it's self-evident how much more activity there is on Bitcoin than on Ethereum than on Bitcoin. But even then it was like pretty clear, you know, like all of this, all of the like craziness and like weirdness of like the 2017 bubble, like so much of it came from Ethereum, like from ICOs and like all these like crazy projects. And yeah, you can like, you know, we can look down on them and whatever, but of course, like so many good things came out of that time. Like a lot of the top DeFi projects came out from that big boom. So I don't know. I think ICOs get an unfairly bad reputation. I think actually a lot of good came out of that boom. But anyways, I think that's what really kind of captured my attention. Just like all of these like crazy dreams, like crazy ideas, like just like all the people building stuff, or like just like even the scammers, you know, just like all those stories. I thought it was just like super interesting, and just like from from going back to the tech, I thought, you know, okay, so Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency, and it wanted to be peer-to-peer money, and that's what it does. But then Ethereum, like when I started to really kind of understand what it does, so Ethereum wants to be a programmable version of Bitcoin, and it wants to allow for peer-to-peer everything, not just peer-to-peer money. So that to me just like felt like a fundamental step forward in blockchain history. And that was just like worth documenting. Like I thought, you know, even if Ethereum doesn't make it, it was still the first blockchain to do this. So it's worth telling the story. Like it was worth like spending all the time to write a book about it.
Was there a specific moment that you remember where you were like, oh yeah, I'm all in on this thing now? Like I let Bitcoin come and go just because it is what it is, but I'm not letting this Ethereum thing come and go or this DeFi thing come and go. Is there like a moment that you had where like, oh, I don't want, I'm now completely focused on crypto?
I think it was very gradual. It was just like, okay, so I at Bloomberg, I started writing about crypto. And to me, that was just like the most interesting story in markets and finance, period. Like, you know, going back to any other market would have been extremely boring. So I did not want to do that. Like crypto was my space. So yeah, I was like writing about crypto every day. And for a while, like I didn't see myself ever leaving Bloomberg. Like, okay. So I even pitched Bloomberg for, I wanted to be the crypto team leader. And I thought, okay, maybe that's kind of my path, you know, like I build out the crypto team at Bloomberg. They didn't listen to me back then, and now they're building their crypto team. I really want to.
We're
going
to put a pin on that one and come back to that one later. But keep going.
Yeah. So it was gradual. I was like started writing about crypto, then thought it was really, you know, it was really a good opportunity to write a book on the history of Ethereum, and then like writing the Infinite Machine, I really made I really wanted to immerse myself in the Ethereum community, because I think what's important about Ethereum is that like it's strength, you know, that the Ethereum community is Ethereum's strength, you know, like other blockchains can claim to have faster tech or whatever, but Ethereum is still leading because it has like all these people building on top of it. So I wanted to like see this community. So I went to like all the conferences and hackathons. And so that's when I realized, you know, these guys and gals are building something real. You know, this is different from ICOs. Like, this stuff is actually working. It has users and volume. And to me, that was just like incredible. You know, like when I started seeing that in 2019, it's like, this actually looks like a parallel financial system. And we're watching it grow from the ground up, like it's emerging in front of our eyes. And I was like, this is incredible. Like, how is nobody seeing this? Like, this is such a huge story. It's so important. Like, this is we're making history. Like, this will change the world. So to me, like, just that, when I realized that, I'm like, this is such a huge opportunity to be here at this time. Like, and it just like didn't make sense to be a Bloomberg reporter, like writing about any other market anymore. It's like, no, like, this is huge. Like, this is where I need to be.
Who was the first like big Ethereum person that you met when you were going to these conferences and getting introduced into the community?
The first, let's see. I mean, my first like interview with an Ethereum co-founder was Charles Hoskinson.
This was for the book?
Yeah.
Charles Hoskinson was the first. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I had actually interviewed him for Bloomberg for like a separate story. Mm. I don't know why. Like, I don't know why. For some, I can't remember. For some reason, I got his contact. Mm-hmm. And of course, like at the time, 2017 reported, I didn't know like the backstory or anything. Right. And Cardano was really like still like a project. At the time, like an idea.
Allegedly, but I thought it was a project, but I'll keep that to myself.
I didn't say that.
No, that was me.
Yeah. So I don't know. So obviously you see Ethereum co-founder, I'm like, oh, like this guy's a big deal. And so I interviewed him for a story at Bloomberg. And I remember that story went viral. It was like, he was like, yeah, this thing is a bubble. And at the time, like, you didn't really, like, crypto people didn't really say that, you know, before the peak. And so the headline was, like, Ethereum co-founder says crypto is a bubble. And that story just, like, went nuts because that's exactly what a lot of Bloomberg readers wanted to hear. Right. So anyway, so I had that contact made with him. And so for, like, at the time of the book, I interviewed him first. To just like start like making my initial outline. Mm-hmm. And then another an interesting story on how I met another Ethereum co-founder is how I met Amir Tetrit. Mm-hmm. And he's like one of the lesser known Ethereum co-founders of the original kind of eighth. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, I think like I had researched him online. Like, he's not on social media. Like, he there's not like an official like company or fund or anything. Like, there was like no way of getting to him. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to interview this guy. And then this was like Consensus 2018 or 2017. It was like maybe like Consensus Invest 2018 or something, like May, March, I don't, well, something around then. And I was getting coffee at like, I don't know, one of like the side booths. And then like this guy comes up to me and just like starts like chatting, like, hey, like, how are you finding the conference? I'm like, oh, I'm good. I'm here reporting. I'm writing a book on Ethereum. And then the guy's friend like starts cracking up. And he's like, oh, you're gonna want to speak to this guy. I'm like, why? Like, who are you? And Amir was like, no, like, no, don't.
It's exactly what I would expect his reaction to be.
Yeah, and the friend was like, no, really, like, you need to talk to this guy. And so I pushed, and he's like, fine, like, I'm one of the co, or like the friend told me, he's like, no, he's like one of the Ethereum co-founders. And
Wow,
that's how
what a lucky
I got
line
that
for coffee
interview.
to be in.
That was so lucky. Yeah, I don't know.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying the conversation with Cami thus far. We're going to get into the second half of the show very shortly here, where we talk about Cami's book, her building the Defiant, where the vision for the Defiant came from, and where it's going to go. So all of that and more right after we take a short moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible. Arbitrum is an Ethereum scaling solution that's going to completely change how we use DeFi and NFTs. And now it's live and has over 100 projects deployed. Gas fees on Ethereum L1 suck. Too many people want to use Ethereum and it doesn't have enough capacity for all of us. And that's why teams like Arbitrum have been hard at work developing layer 2 solutions that makes transactions on Ethereum cheap and instant. Arbitrum increases Ethereum's throughput by orders of magnitude at a fraction of the cost of what we are used to paying. When interacting with Arbitrum, you can get the performance of a centralized exchange while tapping into Ethereum's level of security and decentralization. This is why people are calling this Ethereum's broadband moment, where we get to add performance onto decentralization and security. If you're a developer and you want to save on gas costs and overall make a better user experience, go to developers.offchainlabs.com to get started building on Arbitrum. And if you're a user, keep an eye out for your favorite DeFi apps being built on Arbitrum. Many DeFi applications on the Ethereum L1 are migrating over to layer 2s like Arbitrum, and some are even skipping over the layer 1s entirely and deploying directly on layer 2. There's so many apps coming online to Arbitrum, so go to bridge.arbitrum.io now and start bridging over your ETH or any of the tokens listed and start having the DeFi or NFT experience that you've always wanted.
Living a bankless life requires taking control over your own private keys. Not your keys, not your crypto. That's why so many in the Bankless Nation already have their Ledger hardware wallet, which makes proper private key management a breeze. But the Ledger ecosystem is much more than just a secure hardware wallet. Ledger is the combination of the Ledger hardware wallet and the Ledger Live app. And if you're used to seeing all of your crypto services and favorite DeFi apps all in one spot, Ledger Live is where you want to be. Not only does Ledger let you buy your crypto assets straight from the app, but it also hooks into all of the DeFi apps and services that you're used to. Using Ledger Live, you can stake your ETH in Lido, swap on DEXs like Paraswap, or display your NFTs with Rainbow. You can also use Wallet Connect inside of Ledger Live to connect to all the other DeFi apps that keep coming online. DeFi never stops growing, and the Ledger Live app grows alongside with it. So click the link in the show notes to see all of the DeFi apps that Ledger Live has, and stay tuned as more apps come online. And if you don't have a Ledger hardware wallet, what are you even waiting for? Go to ledger.com, grab a Ledger, download Ledger Live, and get all of your DeFi apps all in one space.
Okay, so we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. I want to go back and you had to pitch someone that they needed to fund this book that you were going to write about Ethereum, right? Like, I've never written a book, so I don't know what this process is like. Can you tell us the story of the genesis of the idea for the Ethereum book and what you had to do to actually turn this idea into reality?
Sure. Yeah, that was, what happened? I was reading The Spider Network by, oh my God, I'm blanking on David, Ehrlich. I'm not sure how you pronounce David Ehrlich. And I looked him up, like I was reading The Spider Network, and it's exactly the kind of book that I always wanted to write, the kind of like Michael Lewis type book, you know, it's like nonfiction, but told in a narrative way so that it seems like a fiction novel. And it was like written like really perfectly and like with so much reporting behind it. And I'm like, this is the book, this is like this, but for Ethereum. And so I looked him up and saw that he was in New York, and I asked him if he could get coffee, and he graciously said yes. So I was like, yeah, just I want to write the kind of book you did. How did he do it? And what should I do? And he put me in touch with his agent. And then, yeah, just like the email was probably like, hey, I want to write a book about crypto, thinking about the story of Ethereum. And the agent was like, yes,
wow.
Let's do it.
Wow.
Like, yes, that was really lucky.
Were you surprised that it was immediate? Yes.
Yeah, I was really surprised because I like obviously I Googled like how to like write a book. And I've heard, you know, like so many horror stories about being rejected by 20 agents and So yeah, no, I was really lucky to just like reach out to David, and he put me in touch with my agent, and then my agent was like instantly like into a crypto book. So yeah, I met with Dan Mandel and told him my idea for this book, which from the start was meant to be a non-technical book about the history of Ethereum, just like the people behind it, the founding story, the like challenges the founding team met, how they overcame that. It was just like more like a people story about Ethereum. And he really liked the idea. And so I had to write this like very like complicated book proposal, complicated in the sense of like what it had to include. It was really like a almost like a business model, a proposal, like a business pitch. It was okay, so what's this book? Why me? Why now? A sample chapter, like I had to write out a chapter. I had to write out the outline of the book with like chapter by chapter, like summaries. Like each chapter had to have like a couple of paragraph summary. So it was just like this huge document. Like what other like the competitive analysis, like what other similar books are there out there? How did they do? It's just like this whole thing. Like it took a while to put together. And then with that, Dan sent that pitch out to a bunch of editorials. And that process was like, it was so nerve-wracking. We had like the tier one editorials. So I started like hearing back from Penguin and like, I don't know, like the other big ones. And some of them were like just really mean, like, no, we don't like her writing. Like, and that like really kind of like, oh,
right
like,
to the
yeah,
heart.
it's right to the heart. Yeah. Or like, no, crypto is dumb, which, that doesn't hurt that much because it's not true. But like, I don't know if like my writing is actually bad, So, but finally, HarperCollins, like one of the bigger ones, says yes. Like that they're interested. Yeah, that was like one of the best days, getting that email like Harper is interested.
Did you
Yeah,
think
I
there was a
heard.
chance that no one was going to say yes?
Oh yeah, I mean, I thought maybe, like maybe I would still publish the book. Like I would self-publish. I would find a way. Like I never thought that the book wouldn't get written. Like I was totally convinced this would get done. But yeah, I didn't know like who would be interested. I was like completely floored to find that that HarperCollins was. And then yeah, then it was like they're interested. They made an offer like for an advance on the book. And then the next step was like meeting with the editor and seeing if they like me. Because apparently like you need to like sell yourself as an author too. So that was yeah. So yeah, that was a really fun, interesting process. Like I don't know. I was like pinching myself throughout that whole thing. Just like going down to HarperCollins office in like downtown Manhattan and like this huge like high rise and amazing offices and just like meeting this like badass editor of like shoot she's my editor was the head of like the business section for HarperCollins. So that was amazing. And then like she was just like really like an amazing editor. Like she had like really good comments on like how helped the book. That was like one of my like concerns going into the process because I know like I had the experience of Bloomberg editors and they are brutal. Like they just like take your stuff apart and it's like constant like revisions and stuff. So I assumed it would be the same with this book, and maybe I would have to like make compromises on what I wanted to say. But no, Hollis, my editor, was amazing. Like, she, all of her like input was on point. And like when I said, no, I actually want to keep this, she was like, fine. She, yeah. So I had such a good experience with that. I will say though, like the next book I write, which I hope to write a second book, I really want to do it the this intermediated way, you know, self-publish, advance from the community, NFT cover, whatever. Like, right. I had my you know, my time with the editors and editorials and publishers, and it was great. Mm-hmm. But I think we have the tools now that I don't need them anymore. Sorry, Polish. I really like you, but you know.
Well, when you are literally writing about a decentralized financial ecosystem, it makes sense that you can find a way to decentralizedly, in a decentralized manner, finance a book, especially when you already have the record of having this book under your belt as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's the case. I've been like thinking about it for some time, and yeah, I think it would be a really cool project. I as soon as I find the time, which I don't know when, but at some point I'll find the time to do that.
Yeah, that is the funny thing about working in crypto, is no one really seems to have any time anymore.
Crazy. No, okay. Yeah.
But Cammy, I do have to give you all the praise that you deserve, because you talked about how the thing that really set Ethereum apart is its community. And I mean, this was certainly true all the way back to almost perhaps even the genesis of Ethereum, but it's only become more and more true as time has gone on. And I think as a quick little history lesson of people that weren't around in Ethereum in 2017 versus where it is now. In 2017, the developers of Ethereum and the investors in Ethereum, and then also like the whole ICO side of things, those were all very separate communities. They weren't very cohered at all. And slowly over those 3 years, that community of developers, investors, users, builders became more and more into this same like canonical Ethereum community. And I really think it was your book, The Infinite Machine, that we can credit a lot of that to. Because for me, an individual who came in 2017, like, I didn't know half of the things that you discovered in the book. And we needed that like documentation as like a, hey, this is actually how this happened. Like, this happened 2 years ago. No one's documented it because like this space moves so incredibly fast. So like for me, the reading that book, there was a very much just like a 0-to-1 moment for understanding where we are in Ethereum history and my place in it as somebody that came in 2017 and where we're going now. And so like the books, like that book in particular, I think did a fantastic job actually allowing the broader Ethereum community to identify itself and really like cohere around a shared vision. And so thank you for that invaluable contribution.
Oh, David, thank you so much. No, I really appreciate you saying that. I did not think that would be like, that wasn't my going into writing this book, but I'm so glad that's been the case for a lot of people. Like, it's incredible to me to just see a lot of the reactions to my book, and just like hear from people who tell me, you know, the reason I got into Ethereum was because of your book, or I decided that I wanted to you know, start building on Ethereum because of your book. Like, that sort of feedback just, I don't know, is makes like the whole experience so worth it, and it's kind of what makes me want to do it again, because like you make an actual impact on people. Like you really, you know, can change people's lives a little bit, or just like help them like find their way. So yeah, no, thank you.
Oh, of course. No, you deserve all of it. And like, you know, Ethereum will pull people in. It'll pull like the investors in because of its reasons. It'll pull the tech builders in for its reasons. But if we're going to pull everyone in, like, it's going to be through stories. Stories are how we're going to scale this whole entire thing out to literally everyone who can't figure out like, why should I care about this whole Ethereum thing?
And like, if they're not investors and they don't know how to code, like what really is it in it for them? And I think in order to pitch it to them, like stories have to be like the last mile to get everyone into this whole entire like movement.
It's so true. And, you know, I think that's where communicators like you and myself and like so many great content creators in this space come in. And I think, you know, Ethereum and just like blockchain, the blockchain space in general has this kind of disadvantage that because it's tech, all of the early people in it are, you know, developers, and developers aren't great at communicating.
They speak different. They're a different breed.
Yeah, I mean, their thing is like building stuff. So they're not there. I mean, it's not their job to do that. Like they're, you know, they're busy creating this stuff. So I think it's so key to have communicators out there representing, you know, holding up a window for people who are not in this space into what all the activity and the potential that there is here. So yeah, I do believe that stories and like stories about the people, mm-hmm. is what brings people in, but also just like the growing number of use cases. I think, sure. You know, that's been really interesting to see this year. So before, I think like the main use case for Ethereum and crypto was just like investing and financial, right? Like buying and selling tokens and trading. But this year with NFTs, we really kind of have seen this like new wave of users that come in. Like there's creators now and like musicians and artists leveraging this tech to connect with their audience, to monetize their art in ways that they couldn't before. And so, you know, it's like, yes, like part of it is communicators amplifying this message and communicating what's happening. But part of it is just like this technology will continue to grow to enable new use cases that will bring different sectors of society in. And, you know, it was like started with finance. We're seeing artists now, and, you know, I think we'll continue seeing other use cases and other like sectors of society come into crypto that way.
100%. Cami, I said earlier that we were going to stick a pin in something, and I think it's time to go back to that. When did the motivations to start the Defiant come?
Well, that's like pretty much, I mean, that's related to what I said before. It's just like writing the Infinite Machine, being immersed in the Ethereum community and seeing DeFi emerge. I just thought, you know, like, there's a huge opportunity here to tell this story. Nobody was doing it. Like at the time when I started the Defiant, this June 2019, there were no DeFi focused newsletters. Like I asked around, I was like, how is nobody seeing this? Like even like crypto media, like CoinDesk and the blogs, they weren't covering DeFi. Yeah. Of course, like mainstream media wasn't covering DeFi. But like, okay, like this is like the biggest revolution in finance, like in I don't know how long, and nobody's covering it. And so
that's what it felt like to be in Ethereum in 2019. Everyone who cared about Ethereum and DeFi was like, am I crazy, or is like what is going on here? Why don't people care about this thing?
It was insane. And so you know, I thought I had already I left Bloomberg in January of 2019 because I wanted to finish the Infinite Machine in the best way possible. And I didn't feel I could do that while at Bloomberg. And I also thought 8 years at the same place was enough time. And I just wanted to be, my initial plan was to become an independent journalist and just like freelance and write about crypto and fintech or whatever. But then, yeah, like I started seeing DeFi and like the huge opportunity there was. And so I thought, you know, I would be a freelance writer and have this DeFi newsletter on the side. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I turned in my first draft of The Infinite Machine, I sent out the first Defiant newsletter a week later on June 11th mm-hmm. of 2019. And so, yeah, I thought, you know, this is going to be something that I do on the side, you know, in the afternoon, like after my freelance work and maybe like, I mean, I obviously had seen how other writers were using Substack to turn on subscriptions. I was like, maybe this will be a good way to like supplement my freelance income, which I didn't expect to be so big. So yeah, that was the whole plan with the Defiant. But then obviously, like, I saw there was a potential for something a lot bigger than just like a tiny newsletter.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. You said when you were at the Defiant, you said you wanted to lead the crypto team, right? At Bloomberg, you wanted to lead the crypto team. And they were like, yeah, no, crypto, it's that weird thing. We don't need that. Yeah. Which is like the greatest thing about crypto is that like we generally don't get any help externally. As an industry, like no one outside of crypto helps us. We have to learn how to help ourselves. And so mm-hmm. the crypto native, we have to make our own institutions. Like Bloomberg's not going to write DeFi stuff on our behalf. And so we need to do it ourselves. And so like, you know, the media has to come from inside the industry. And so, all right, you started the Defiant. It was just going to be a side gig newsletter to, you know, put some excess time into. But that's not what it is now. It's something much larger. So when did you realize that the Defiant could be something much more than a newsletter?
Yeah, so I started writing it. And first of all, like, just like keeping up with DeFi was a full-time job, you know, like I was spending so much time between. I was like writing, still writing my book during the day. And then I would start writing the Defiant like in the afternoon. And I would go like really late into the night, like to just like get it out the next morning and just like keeping up with all the news. Yeah, it was a lot. So I realized, okay, it's not so easy to like run a daily newsletter. And then, you know, it really started to like, gain a lot of traction. Like people were subscribing. I didn't really have any growth strategy or anything. It was just like my own Twitter. I was sharing the Defiant that way, and like people were sharing it, and it just like started to grow. So I just like saw interest there for what I was doing, and people were just like kept giving me amazing feedback. And then I decided to test whether, you know, people were willing to pay for that content. So I think it was like maybe November, October. I set up like the paid version of the Defiant, which is basically, you know, I just like I had two versions, and one version had more content than the other. And like I realized people were willing to pay for the content I was producing. And that was mind blowing to me because just like putting the Defiant out there under like my own name without the Bloomberg brand, without like a dozen editors like looking after my stories, that was really scary to start out with. And then like to see not only like I can do this and like and get readers and get people interested, but like people are willing to pay for this content. So that was like kind of the first sign that, okay, maybe there's something here. And then I started getting like DeFi projects and companies who wanted to sponsor the newsletter. So I started just like getting emails being like, hey, like how much is the sponsorship? And I wasn't offering sponsorships at the time. So like,
was that a conscious choice? As in like, no, I don't want sponsors. Or it's like, oh, I forgot that I could sponsor this. Yeah. Like the second one?
The second one, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like I didn't think about it. And at first it was also like, I wonder if like having sponsors will, you know, affect like my journalism. Like that was also a concern. So I was like, I wasn't sure about the whole like sponsorship thing, but at least I knew that people were interested in paying for the Defiant, like paying to be featured, paying to read it. So I realized, okay, there's a business here. And I decided to go all in and, you know, forget about freelancing and yeah, just like make sure like that I could build it out into something bigger.
Mm-hmm. Where'd the name Defiant come from?
I don't know. I think it was like looking for variations of DeFi. Mm-hmm. So like, I think I have the notebook where I put like down like all the different names, mm-hmm. like DeFi Weekly, DeFi Daily, DeFi Standard, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then like, my husband Chris helped me out with the name. So I need to give him credit for that. We were both like thinking about it. I think like on a plane, I don't know, like planes are such good places to like brainstorm stuff. Like
now, what else really, are you going to do?
You really can focus. Yeah. So I think it was on a plane that we were like both like going over this notebook of names. And then I thought, you know, I don't want it to be so obvious, like right. DeFi something. So it was like with that idea in mind, like I wanted like, yeah, the sense of like defying, but and not have like the actual name DeFi, mm-hmm. and yeah,
but close, but not actually DeFi, but close enough.
Close enough, yeah.
I remember in it might have been 2018, so this might have been settled by then. But I definitely think it went into 2019. There was a time where me, Eric, Connor, Ryan, Sean Adams, we were like, DeFi is a shitty name. Like OpenFi, Open Finance is better. Were you watching us have those conversations on Twitter? And you're like, I hope these guys like stop doing this.
I think so. I know. Yeah. I don't know if it's a great name. But whatever, you know, I think like it is what it is. Like
people, at this point, DeFi is absolutely stuck. Yeah. And the Define is a fantastic name. It exudes so much of crypto values in a single word, which I think is fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I really love it. Mm-hmm. And then like, yeah, I designed the logo on Canva myself. still need to get like an actual designer.
Right. Yeah. No, this is the same thing at Bankless. I picked out the font, drew a red line under the word Bankless, and then boom, that's been our logo since day one.
And it works. It's awesome.
Okay. So when did you hire your first employee at the Defiant? And who was that?
Ah, good question. Well, So employee different from contributor, right? So I had
paid labor. Who was the labor. First paid labor? Yeah.
Who was it? You know, it might have been Lucas, who's at Bankless now.
Oh, no way. Really?
Seriously. I think
oh,
so.
That's funny.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know if he was the first. He was definitely one of the first. Mm-hmm. There was also Sebastian Saldas. I don't know how to say it in English, mm-hmm. but this guy Seba from Argentina, he was also writing for the Defiant, and then Cooper,
right?
Cooper. He was also one of the first writers. So yeah, I had kind of that plan.
When did the vision change from just a newsletter that you write, realize that you could monetize to a much more grand media company? Was there ever an like aha moment, or was that just kind of a slow transition?
It was also a slow transition. It was like, okay, I had the daily newsletter. Then I decided I wanted to have a weekly interview. Mm-hmm. And with the weekly interview, I was already recording it. So it was like, might as well have a podcast. Right. So that happened. And then Robin reached out because he had interviewed me for a documentary while he was at Harmony. Mm-hmm. And he said, we are looking to like reach the DeFi audience. So can I make videos for the Defiant? And like Harmony appears as a sponsor, but like we just like make videos about DeFi. I'm like, as long as like we don't have to talk about Harmony, that's fine. Like, and so he started the Defiant YouTube channel. At first, just like doing this like kind of joint partnership with Harmony, And then I brought him on full time. And so, yeah, that was like, suddenly I had a lot of content because I had a bunch of contributors writing stories for the newsletter. I had the podcast and I had the videos. And so it just like, it didn't make sense. Like the Define just like started to look like more of like a media company than a newsletter, because we had like all these like these different types of content, and it just like didn't fit in the newsletter anymore. Like it didn't make sense to have like all those stories. It just like was getting too like unwieldy. So so I made a WordPress website together with a designer, and I just started like, you know, publishing on the website primarily, and then the newsletter was the summary of what we had done elsewhere. And with that, then like when all those pieces started to emerge, then is like I started to have like a bigger vision for the Defiant. This was, yeah, probably early last year. I started to see, you know, there's something bigger here. And, you know, with my background at Bloomberg, to me, information is content and data. Like, you know, it's like you need both of them, because, you know, it's like you tell stories, you write, and, you know, you communicate stories. But you also need to provide the data for people to, you know, see what's happening in the market and on-chain themselves.
Yeah, without the data, it's just subjective stories, which is what you wanted to get away from way back when.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought, you know, nobody's doing the data part right. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think the DeFi data space is really fragmented. I think, you know, there, you have like different trackers and websites doing very specific things, but you don't have like one place to get all of the DeFi data that you could need. And, you know, there's also, you just like can't get the same user experience you can with a Bloomberg terminal. So I was just like really missing that, that ability of just like this like magical black box that I described earlier, you know, like, okay, you get to this place, you start typing up something and it comes up and you can chart it and compare it with other things and other metrics. You just don't have that. And it's so needed. So I decided, you know, this is what the Define should be. It should be the Bloomberg of DeFi. So we become the most trusted, like, journalistic news source for DeFi, and we provide the data to track and analyze the space. And that's kind of when the big vision formed, and it became clear to me, this is what I need to do. Like, this is the big vision, and this is what's like really needed in this space.
So the you recently launched that data platform. So this just is almost like going back to what we were saying at the very beginning, where like who you are seems to be a very logical combination of like all the components of your family. And so mm-hmm. this also seems to be that what the Defiant is turning into. It seems to be a very logical conclusion of your history as a journalist, right? Like love journalism, but you love journalism even more when it's grounded in objective facts that no one can argue with. Right.
Exactly.
And so like the Defiant is turning into this one half story, one half information, one half data to back that up. And you're doing that all in-house. And so you are trying to be like, both the story behind the data, and then also the data simultaneously in all the same spots.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the platform to get all the insights that you need from DeFi, and we have the writers to like take those insights and put it into words and into context and tell those stories.
Where does narrative come into this, or does it at all? Like more subjective, more, you know, Yeah, more subjective, less concrete, like visions of like, because everyone has like visions of what the future of crypto will be, right? Like it's completely unwritten. You know, Bitcoin's only 12 years old, but you know, Ethereum's only 6 years old. DeFi is only 2.5 years old. So there's a bunch of competing narratives as to what the future of DeFi looks like. Where does narrative fit into the Defiant, or does it at all?
No, I think that's Bankless job. I think the Defiant, you know, there is some level of subjectiveness, like, so our editorial point of view is that DeFi is the future, you know, like we believe in Web3, we believe the world will be increasingly decentralized, we believe DeFi will become finance, but how that happens, on what chain, you know, who wins, whatever, like all of that, we leave it to our readers to decide. Our job is to report on the space objectively, and you know, to tell the stories that are happening in the way that they're happening, in a very kind of data-backed way, and the reader can decide for themselves what they think is right or wrong, or you know, where they want to trade or what, you know, they can make their own narrative. So of course there's space for opinion, and we do have guest writers, and we have op-eds, and I think Robin is pretty opinionated in his coverage. So there's room for that, but I don't think the main purpose of the Defiant isn't to like deliver a shaped narrative, but it's to give people the tools to discover, you know, what their own narrative is, to make up their own mind.
I love that answer. That's fantastic. Cami, if the Defiant is maximally successful, what does it look like in 5 years?
Okay, so I would love for the Defiant to be the place where people can find all of the, well, let's see. I want the Defiant to be the most trusted source of information for DeFi. I wanted to illuminate the space for people just coming in. So like for it to be an education source for newcomers, and for it to be a very powerful tool for insiders as well. But I also want to make a change in journalism in general. So, you know, of course, being in Web3, we are looking for ways. We're looking at how media looks like in Web3. So you guys at Bankless have done an amazing job in decentralizing Bankless. I'm also looking at, you know, how that looks like for like a news company, for a media company, because you know I do want to open up the Defiant, and I want to do it in a way that stays true to our mission of providing like trusted information. So you know, there's like it is a bit of a challenge there, because you need to retain some level of control to have that kind of just like standards and like quality for like news. But I think there's a way to do that in a more decentralized way. So yeah, I want the Defiant to be the most trusted information source for DeFi. And I also wanted to just like push boundaries of what media looks like in Web3. And what the ultimate goal that I want the Defiant to help shape is just like a better version of journalism. Like what if like the Web3 media model improves like traditional journalism? You know, right now investigative journalism is basically dead. What if we can reshape media in a way that we can find new funding mechanisms and you know, new ways to organize community, so that we can create we can revive investigative journalism, and we can, what if this like new media model makes it so that, you know, the bigger stories come from just like a Web3 native community. So that's kind of a vision that's still kind of not fully formed, but that's really exciting and inspiring for me, and like where we're, I'd want to take the DeFi going forward.
Well, we all know that this whole Web3 phenomenon is a place to tinker with incentives, and where Web2 generally all incentives and alignments is kind of like broken down. Mm-hmm. And like in the world of journalism, it's exactly what you said, where there's no more investigative journalism. There's only stories and narratives left in the Web2 world, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so that is a very bullish outlook for the world of media. And I definitely hope that something definitely fulfills this vision of reorchestrating incentives with regards to journalism.
I think we have such a big opportunity here. Like, I think we're all going to make it.
Nice. Just a last few quick questions. What's it like to be in crypto in New York?
Oh, it's awesome. Actually, like I'm launching this co-working space in Brooklyn. So it's cool. Like there's like lots of projects and people based here. I think, you know, the city is coming alive again with meetups and parties and just like, you know, just random meetings that I think it's like when in the middle of the pandemic we kind of forgot how useful those things were. It's like, okay, like we can do everything from our apartment on Zoom, but like those like just like random conversations and meetings and meetups are, you know, you can't really replace them. So it's good to be in a city that just like has that community and those opportunities. So that's something I want to enable in the Defiance co-working space colony. So,
well, I missed going to your office launch event last time I was in New York, but maybe I will be able to see you for NFT NYC.
Oh yeah, you should drop by.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, I'd love to have you here. And I think there's going to be like an NFT scavenger hunt.
I don't know what that means, but that sounds like a ton of fun.
Yeah. And I think one of the spots will be the Defiant office. So you can also get an NFT out of your trip.
Awesome. Well, we all love NFTs. Cammy, one last question for you. Are you a pessimist or an optimist?
Absolutely an optimist. Yeah.
What about the world makes you optimistic?
I mean, what we're doing. Like we're changing the world. We're changing finance. We're changing, you know, how people organize. I'm hugely optimistic that that this technology is going to change things for the better. Like I just think it's inherently better, more efficient. It's, you know, literally cuts out intermediaries, so makes things faster and better. So at its core, it's better tech. And so that means that we have the opportunity of improving how things work. I think that's hugely bullish and makes me super optimistic about the future. And also just very grateful to be part of it, to be here.
Well, Cammy, I'm grateful for you coming on and spending an hour and a half with me. So thank you for coming on Layer Zero.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Again, like really enjoyed this conversation, really unique question. So thank you so much for having me.
Cheers.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed the video. If you did, head over to Bankless HQ right now to develop your crypto investing skills and learn how to free yourself from banks and gain your financial independence. We recommend joining our daily newsletter, podcast, and community as a Bankless Premium subscriber to get the most out of your Bankless experience. You'll get access to our market analysis, our alpha leaks, and exclusive content, and even the Bankless token for airdrops, raffles, and unlocks. If you're interested in crypto, the Bankless community is where you want to be. Click the link in the description to become a Bankless Premium subscriber today. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the channel for in-depth interviews with industry leaders, Ask Me Anythings, and weekly roll-ups where we summarize the week in crypto and other fantastic content. Thanks everyone for watching and being on the journey as we build out the Bankless Nation.